Our next case this afternoon is Lewis versus Goslin. Lewis versus Goslin, when you're ready, you may approach.
Your Honors, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, you may.
Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is John P. Farrell, and I represent the appellants, Corey Lewis and Elizabeth N. Lewis. I would like to start by renewing my arguments proffered in the appellant's brief and emphasize some key points. We're here today for no other reason, but we have a contract for the real property that is an example of what not to do when writing contracts. I mean, it's a clear example of a law school textbook case, as you see. But before we get to that contract, I would like to talk about the order issued October 1st, 2021 in this case. It was issued 5 months after the trial. Now, I would never mention 5 months or even think about the time it would take a judge to give an order because there's a lot that goes into it. However, opposing counsel had reached out to the judge to see as an inquiry. The judge apologized to both myself and opposing counsel that he had forgot that he did not make that he did not rule on the case because there were other cases that the appellee was a part of, and he thought he'd already made that order. And the only reason I bring that up is because today the appellate review is de novo. However, we're supposed to give deference to the trial court's decision because he's there witnessing the proffered evidence, witnessing the witnesses as they take the stand. And clearly, we can see that this order was just done by notes.
And why do you say that? That it's clear?
If he didn't remember that he ruled on the case, then how can he remember the case itself after 5 months?
That happens a lot, doesn't it? And do we know if he had the court reporter transcribe any of the testimony or anything like that?
We don't.
Yeah.
We understand that he did take notes. So I would just like to make note for that for this court.
Yeah, and we review it de novo.
Thank you. The main point of this case is the contract itself. Did the contract have enough certainty and definiteness to be a valid contract at the time of contracting? In Sayre versus Boley and Satellite versus Debco versus Burnt, this court stated that there must be an offer, acceptance, and a meeting of minds and on every point, and nothing can be left open for future arrangement. Let's start with the sale of the property. There was 11.4 acres that the appellant had for sale. There was a third party involved in this case that in May of 2013 signed a purchase agreement for 9.27 acres. After a survey, they changed that purchase agreement, made an addendum for 8.4 acres, leaving 3 acres left for purchase. The close of that sale was to be when the 3 acres that held the house owned by the appellant was sold. In August of that year, that third party, the Welches, filed a notice of interest in real property in Washington County. Fast forward 2 months later, or a month and a half later, on October 1st, we get to the OPUS, the purchase agreement, which is Exhibit 11 in the record. We start at the beginning of the contract. It does reference the 8.4 acres sold or purchase agreement between the Welches and the appellant. It then explains that the for sale that the appellees were purchasing 3 acres. Following that, it goes on to the recitals. And section one, titled track size, it says the track size from seller to purchaser shall contain 4 acres.
That's the only reference to four in this whole document, isn't it?
To 4 acres?
Mm-hmm.
I believe so. However, I mean, in the entire record, it talks about whether it was 4 or 3 because they didn't understand, you know, how much property they were selling, where the Welches were purchasing.
Is that because there was going to be an attempt to do a lot split? Is that what the record shows?
Yes, there was going to be a lot split.
Okay. So it's your position that because of the uncertainty in the number of acres, the contract is ambiguous?
Absolutely. There wasn't enough definiteness and certainness of how much the property was for. And if the first in time and the third party had an addendum, which they've already changed there, knowing that they're purchasing 8.4 acres, why would this contract not contemplate their contract at 8.4 and change it from 3 to 4 acres?
Does it matter, though, in the sense that the contract goes on to say if the Welches don't close on their 8 point whatever acres, that then the Goslins would buy the entire tract?
Yes, that is correct. It does say that, but that's the 11.4. We're still talking about the original purchase agreement that's in place for 8.4 and the purchase agreement for three acres.
But we know early on that the Welches aren't going to close.
So we say that. However, the trial court gave deference to the notice of lease pendants further on, saying when we talk about reasonable time to close. So I'll get to that point because it's a circular argument. So if we say the Welches were out of this case, then okay, then later on when we talk about a reasonable time to close and you say, well, there was a defect because the lease pendants was valid and they couldn't clear the defect, and that would mean the Welches weren't out of the case. So it's a circular argument. So if you say the lease pendants is valid and that it's a reasonable time to close, then that means that the Welches' original contract for 8.4 acres is valid. If it's not, then that means that it's not a reasonable time to close. So when we move on to those statements of the 7.4 or 8.4, it goes on to say that if the purchasers of the 8.4 acres back out due to the 8.4 becoming 7.4, well, what does that mean? We're not talking about 11.4. It says just 7.4 acres. Now, it obviously was confusing enough that there wasn't enough certainty and definiteness. You know, if we look back at the judge's order, the judge looked at the same thing. He looked at my brief on page 14, where all the parties are confused. And he states that in the record. Additionally, you can't have a purchase agreement that alters another purchase agreement unless everybody's in agreement and they're all party to the cases, such as in Dakota Gasification Company versus Natural Gas Pipeline. The judge in his order, proffered his order considering that the Welches were completely out of it. But yet he still considered the lease pendants a defect and didn't even talk about the chance for them to be able to clear that defect.
But isn't it really two different things? Welches had no intention of closing on the property. And I think all parties acknowledged that for a few years, right? The lease pendants, it goes more to getting clear title for financing. And you can't close until you get clear title.
Yeah, I understand that. However, you have up until the time of close to clear that title. Opposing counsel, references Snowden Farms. Well, the difference between our case and Snowden Farms is the fact is the defect. Now, the appellees went into their purchase agreement knowing that there was a lease pendants in the property, knowing that there was another purchase agreement. They knew that before they got into the contract. You knew that in Snowden Farms, they didn't know there was a mortgage. And on top of that, they couldn't clear that defect. Well, that wasn't even an opportunity for my clients to clear the defect. It didn't even get to that point. And the judge made a decision on that, saying that it was a reasonable time to close. 5 years is not a reasonable time to close. Once again, I renew all arguments in appellate's brief and ask this court to overturn the trial court decision, award the property to the appellants, and all the requests for relief stated in the appellate's brief.
Thank you.
Thank you. We can't see the clock. Where are we normally?
Yeah, I couldn't see it.
You couldn't see it either?
I was looking over there, and I had it over there.
Hold on just 1 second. Yeah. We cannot see the time remaining.
Okay.
Okay. I just realized there that. There we go. Right. Okay.
Appreciate it.
Thank now, you. Can they see it also on?
I'm there. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Perfect.
Is there? Okay. Yeah. Is this great. Light go on?
It evidently just burned.
Okay, oh, sorry.
That's okay. If only my vision were a bit better, then we'll be fine. Thank you. No, that's okay.
Just jiggle it.
Oh, that's
your remedy.
That's what we do at home.
That's a lot brighter. Thank you.
Okay, very well. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Jim McVeigh. I'm the attorney for the appellees, Mick and Beth Goslin, in the case now before the court. Before I get to the merits of the arguments presented by the appellants, I'd like to renew my motion for a dismissal of this case based on mootness. As the court may recall, I filed a suggestion of mootness on August 3rd, 2022. The court denied that motion without prejudice and gave me the opportunity to renew that motion today. I cited a number of cases in my brief, and I'm sure the court's had an opportunity to look at those. In the course of timeline from the time of submission of briefs to today, I found another case, Your Honors, that I think is important. It's a more recent 2018 case. It's a Beecher versus Beecher, and that's at 299 Nebraska 206. In Beecher, a divorce case, the trial court had awarded the wife 3 commercial properties. The husband filed a motion to set supersedious, and an order was entered, but the husband never filed the supersedious bond. I'm sure the court remembered this case because it came here and then went to the Supreme Court. Thereafter, the husband went ahead and quitclaimed the 3 commercial properties to the wife. When this case was reviewed by this Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals determined that because the husband had transferred property as directed by the court order, but nonetheless transferred it, that he had waived his right to appeal that portion of the decree. The Supreme Court reversed that decision and found, in fact, that the husband had not waived his right to appeal, at least the transfer of 2 of the properties, claiming that the husband's transfer was not an acceptance of a benefit, but an involuntary acceptance of a detriment because it was the wife, not the husband, that accepted the benefits of the transaction. I would suggest to the court, as I indicated in my suggestion of mootness, that unlike the parties in Beecher, the Lewises have accepted a clear benefit of this transaction. They received $120,000 as the remaining balance owed for the purchase of the property. That included a cash payment of $54,000 directly from the Goslins. They paid off their first mortgage on the property to Wells Fargo. They have a promissory note in the amount of $55,000 at 4.5% interest. And the warranty deed in this case that was transferred, signed by the Lewises in April of 2022, did not contain any reservation of rights. And this court is clear that in the absence of a preponderance of evidence, clear and convincing in character, establishing some recognized exception, such as fraud or mistake of fact, the deed will be held to truly express the intentions of the parties.
Does it make any difference that they were compelled to do so by court order?
I don't think there were options available to the appellants to post a supersedious bond and avoid that outcome. As the court's well aware, as you review the record, that was filed untimely. In fact, it was filed after the notice of appeal was filed. And I believe that at that point, the trial court lost jurisdiction to even set a supersedious. Had they managed the property, the process correctly, they could have posted a supersedious, and avoided any issues whatsoever concerning waiver based on the transaction. And again, even by virtue of the fact that they received the benefit, if it had been something that they transferred without any type of benefit in return, that might be a reasonable argument, but we don't think it applies to these facts. The arguments raised by the appellants are several. The one that we discussed principally today is that the contract was not definite. Judge Sampson did a good job in his order outlining why he believed the order that the contract was definite in nature. Interestingly enough, he refers specifically to paragraph 10 of the second amended complaint, an issue that the appellants have not addressed either in their brief or today. Paragraph 10 of the second amended complaint, Judge Sampson considered to be a judicial admission by the appellants that there was a contract, an enforceable contract in place. Paragraph 10 says, on or about October 1st, 2013, plaintiffs and the first defendants, the Goslins, entered into a written purchase agreement for defendants to purchase real estate at an agreed upon price of $9,325 per acre, or 8.4 acres of undeveloped land, in addition to 3.0 acres of developed land at $95,000 for a total purchase price of $173,330. This provides very clear evidence to the court, and again, a judicial admission by the plaintiffs, by the appellants, that there was a specific contract for a specific parcel of a specific price, or of a specific size for a specific price. I believe, Your Honors, as you review the evidence, the notion that the contract is not definite enough fails in terms of a basis to reverse the trial court's ruling. There was significant discussion both at trial and in the briefs regarding the passage of time. And I have cited to a number of cases in our brief that I think are relevant to that issue. The Snowden case, as referred to by counsel, is particularly on point. Judge Moore, you are correct when you indicated that the Liz Pendens was not the same as, didn't affect the transaction and the decision as to the quantity of land that they were going to produce or purchase, nor did it affect the ability of the parties to potentially close. All it did do was indicate that the Liz Pendens had to be cleared before the closing could actually take place. But it was very clear among the parties throughout the 7-year timeframe that the Welshes were not going to purchase the ground and that the Goslins were going to purchase all 11.4 acres.
And did they in fact occupy all 11.4 acres after they moved onto the property?
Yes. So the Welshes never occupied any portion of the parcel that was potentially at sale. The only thing the Welshes did was file their notice of intent to purchase early on. And of course, as the evidence showed, both text messages from Mr. Lewis, other communication between the parties, the Welshes were out of it quite early. There is no doubt that the Lewises could have taken care of the Welshes' cloud on the title prior to 3 weeks before trial. They didn't do that.
Was there any indication in the record as to why, if the Welshes were out of this, as long as they're out of it, why they wouldn't remove that?
The only thing, Your Honor, is if you look at Mr. Lewis's deposition testimony, his testimony at trial, more importantly, his deposition testimony, he referred and said a number of times in his deposition that the Lewises or the Welshes were out of it. In fact, he said that as early as March 24, 2018, expletive Welshes, I don't care, they're out of it. So I don't know why the Lewises didn't take some action towards that cloud, other than, as with all other issues surrounding this case, they didn't really do anything to push the transaction forward. And principally because they were receiving the monthly payments from the Goslins, and there was not any great incentive to do so. That's at least, I think, what the record would show.
Okay, before your time's up here, I want to discuss a little bit about the $6,000 plus dollars in rent that the sellers ultimately didn't accept because they were trying to seek restitution finally at some point in this thing. Shouldn't they owe them $6,000 for that rent?
I don't think you're so, Your Honor, and this is why. When the Goslins tendered those checks, and Mr. Lewis indicated quite clearly they did, there was no communication from the Lewises about why they weren't not depositing the checks. Counsel for the appellant cited to the case, and I apologize, Your Honors, I can't find the citation here, referenced the case in which the landlord had indicated to the tenant that they weren't going to deposit checks until an arrangement was reached. I think it was Kinzer. In this case, there was no such communication from the Lewises. They never said to the Goslins, we're not going to deposit your checks because we have a potential claim for restitution of premises or any other communication. They either tore them up and put them in the trash can or mailed them back.
Isn't that common, though, when you're seeking restitution of the premises to stop accepting rent?
And I think at trial, Mr. Lewis indicated that he had heard something from a lawyer to not do that. But that was never communicated to the Goslins. And for the Goslins as tenants, which is what the court determined they were, to know and to take that failure to deposit as something tied to a restitution case, I think puts on them the burden to anticipate and guess what Mr. Lewis was doing.
What would you cite as to as it relates to the authority that would be? That they get to live rent free for those 6 months.
I'd cite you to State X Rel Wagner versus Amwest Surety, which says there must be a
clear. Give me the cite, please.
Yes, it is 280 Nebraska 729.
Thank you.
It's a 2010 case. It says, in order for there to be a waiver, there must be a clear, unequivocal and decisive act of Lewis demonstrating that he voluntarily and intentionally relinquished a known right or privilege. Our claim is when he tore up those checks and returned them, he was indicating quite clearly in the most egregious way and obvious way possible that he wasn't accepting those payments. For the Goslins to believe that was tied to some potential future litigation, I think is a stretch. So I don't believe they're entitled to get the $6,000 as suggested.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. How much time is remaining for the appellant?
2 seconds.
Mr. Farrell, 22 seconds-ish.
Okay. First, the mootness, this argument has already been seen. You saw it on the record. We tried to file for a supersedious. We asked the judge, 3 days prior to the 30 day, can you give us a supersedious or would you like to schedule a court date? He said, we schedule a court date. And that date was after the 30 days. By the time we had an opportunity to get there, he said, oh, you missed the 30 days. The judge told us to schedule that court date.
And is that in the record?
It could be somewhere in the record. We did not appeal. We did not appeal that because it puts us in the same position that we're here today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you, counsel. You are excused and your case is submitted.